Yeah, so thank you very much for inviting me to this beautiful meeting, and thank you for coming so early to this talk. As you see from the screen, I have put a subtitle to my talk, which says From Secured Land to Unknown Territory. And basically what I'm planning to do is, after some motivational remarks and some explanation why the challenge of combining gravity with quantum mechanics is so difficult, I will explain you what we know in loop quantum gravity, what are the robust results, and then what is so-called unknown territory, where there are only partial results so far, and what are the open research problems. And then I will close with some open questions and some summary. So let's start with the motivation. Cosmology has stepped into a new era since the satellites such as COBE, WMAP, and Planck have provided us with high-precision data. What you see here, for example, are the temperature fluctuations or the relative temperature fluctuations analyzed by the WMAP satellite. And what we show is in directional dependence of the temperature fluctuations of the cosmological background radiation. Now, one of the things that WMAP for sure has given us is a certain puzzle, which has been around, of course, for a longer time, which arises from the assumption that if general relativity is correct until the very early time, let's say the Planck time or something like this, then of course there's, as we all know, there's a Big Bang, so time had a beginning, and this provides us with the so-called horizon problem. If you look into the sky, into antipodal directions, then you see that at the point of time when this radiation was created that reaches us today, which is here in a two-dimensional plot, is not a sphere, but a circle. And you see at the antipodal times, the domain of dependence of these points are never intersecting with each other. So there shouldn't be any correlations of the cosmological background radiation coming from these points, but we do observe them because the relative temperature fluctuations are 10 to the minus 4. So this gives us a puzzle, and you know all that there's a possible very popular resolution, which is if you assume that there's exotic matter, so matter which doesn't satisfy the usual energy conditions, then you can solve this problem, and usually it's called an inflaton or inflationary solution, which basically consists of the idea that if there's rapid expansion in the early universe, then the domains of dependence of these two points now are overlapping with each other. So that's the basic idea. And it leads to the so-called cosmological Big Bang standard model, where there is an inflationary period in the beginning of the universe. But it gives you also some all kinds of problems. For example, I mean, what is the inflaton? We never observed it. How did it decay? But there's an even more interesting possibility, namely, as I said, all of this hinges on the fact that you assume that general relativity is valid until the very, very early times. Is this really a valid assumption? Maybe you can... Okay. This is not the Big Bang. This is not the Big Bang, I hope. So if you somehow assume that there's quantum mechanics around, then maybe the gravitational singularity, the Big Bang singularity, can be avoided. Like in the hydrogen atom, where you cannot explain the stability of the hydrogen atom by using just classical physics, but you have to invoke quantum mechanics. So if that would be the case, then the inflaton wouldn't be necessary, and there would be possibly a pre-Big Bang. And we come to the next motivational remark, which is about dark energy. As you all know, we understand only about 4% of the matter that is around in the universe. 21% is dark matter and 75% is dark energy. Nobody knows what it is. For dark energy, a possible candidate is, of course, a cosmological constant, and it gives you a very big puzzle. So let me just run this argument for those of you who have not seen this yet. So take a free scalar field on Minkowski space and consider the vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian, and subtract from it the normal ordered piece, which we usually use, then, of course, we know that the ground state oscillations or the vacuum fluctuations of the scalar field actually should contribute to the cosmological constant. And if you do this calculation, then it's just plain infinite. But if you assume that there's a naive quantum gravity cutoff, then you should cut off this momentum integral by around 1 over the Planck length or something like this. So you get this result. And if you compare it to the cosmological term, then you get the worst prediction in the history of physics, namely that you're off by an order of 120. So it's a big puzzle. What is dark energy? And dark energy, and if it's a cosmological constant, why is it so tiny? Then we come to black holes. There are many puzzles with black holes. I will just use this one. So classical theorems by Penrose and Hawking tell us that there's a so-called error law. Physical processes in classical GR can never increase the error, decrease the error of a black hole, which reminds you of the second law of thermodynamics. And if you put in Hawking's calculation based on the assumption that there's quantum field theory on, let's say, a Schwarzschild black hole space-time, then you discover that a black hole is actually a black radiator with a wavelength of the order of 1 over the Schwarzschild radius. And if you combine these two things, then you get to the speculation that there should be associated an entropy to a black hole, which is given by this formula due to Bekenstein and Hawking, namely that the entropy of the black hole should be something like the area of the black hole divided by 4 times the Planck length squared. And the puzzle is, of course, how do you explain microscopically where this entropy comes from? There's a speculative answer to this question due to Toft and Suskind, which assume that the black hole horizon is actually made of triangles or something like this, and 4 triangles combine to 1 bit of data. This is sometimes also embedded in this holographic explanation of black hole entropy, but it's, of course, a speculative answer because it hasn't been derived from first principles. So let me come to next topic, namely to explain why quantum gravity is such a difficult problem to solve. So all of these puzzles and more are widely believed to be only possible to answer or to be resolved by a full-fledged quantum gravity theory. And I want to explain now why it's so difficult. And then I think that there's a, you can actually pinpoint where this, why it's so difficult. So let me recall that gravity is geometry, and curvature is equal to matter energy density according to Einstein's equations. And these Einstein equations display a fundamental principle, which is the principle of background independence. The Einstein equations tell you that geometry is nothing rigid or say static or something like this that you can put in by hand and then you let matter propagate in it, but there's a back reaction. There's geometry and matter talk to each other. This is very much, I mean, a drastic example where this happens, that geometry is a very dynamical object. It's in binary systems where, for example, this double star system here, where you have gravitational waves distorting the flat curvature, space-time geometry. So we have background independence in general relativity, but in usual quantum field theory, we don't have that. We have background dependence. So let me illustrate this with one of the fundamental axioms of, let's say, Weidman quantum field theory, Minkowski space. So if you take two field operators and you sphere them with test functions, which are such that the support of these test functions are space-like separated with respect to a background metric, then you require that the field operators have vanishing commutator. This is a very fundamental axiom in the framework of quantum field theory. And what you see is that given a background metric, you know what the light cone structure is, then you know what the algebra is, the algebra of field operators, and only then you can talk about representations of this algebra on a Hilbert space. So if you don't have a background metric, which is fundamental for usual quantum field theory, then the whole framework collapses in a sense. Furthermore, if you do this, then you, of course, ignore gravitational back reaction. Especially in those regimes where we are very much interested in extreme astrophysical and cosmological situations where you have singularities, this should be a very bad approximation. And the perturbative approach, as we all know, suffers from the problem of non-renormalizability. So what we need is something more fundamental, something more general, the quantum Einstein equations, which are very radical. If you think about it, are radical generalizations of the principles of quantum field theory and on curved space-time, in that it doesn't assume a quantum field theory on the curved background, but you only have a differential manifold. So you get rid of the background structure, you have something new. This, of course, means in particular that we can't use perturbation techniques using Fock spaces, because Fock spaces very much depend on the background structure. So let me show this pictorially, what's going on here. This would be the situation that we have in quantum field theory in curved spacetime. There's a rigid spacetime structure, and electrons like this somehow propagate through this rigid spacetime structure. On the other hand, in what we are trying to do, geometry and matter are somehow depending on each other, and for example, matter can only exist where geometry is excited. And this is the challenge. We want to construct a microscopic theory up here. These are five magnifying glasses put on top of each other. So this is about at the Planck scale, and here we have to construct a theory which at large scales recovers the smooth spacetime structure that we are used to. So let me now come to the first part using on loop quantum gravity, which is the secured land, the robust results that we have so far. Loop quantum gravity uses a canonical framework, so we split space-time into space and time. So here are the two spatial directions, here's one time direction, and the third direction, of course, is suppressed. And then you based on this a Hamiltonian formulation. So one possible starting point is this Palatini action with a topological term, which is on-shell topological. And if you do the Legendre transformation, then you discover that these are the canonical pairs. So this is the curvature of this SO1,3 connection, and these are the tetrad fields. And if you do the Legendre transformation, then you see that these two fields are canonically conjugate to each other. But it's immediately clear that these are not free from constraints. For example, there's the so-called simplicity constraint, which says that the E's are not independent of each other, which is clear that from the fact that the tetrads have only 16 degrees of freedom, while, for example, the connection has 4 times 6, which are 24 degrees of freedom. So there, you have to get rid of some of these variables. And there's also a spin 1,3 Gauss constraint, and further spatial diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints, which I'm not displaying here. And the system of constraints turns out to be second class, so you have to get rid of some of these constraints by using the Dirac procedure. And what you end up with is the following canonical pair. This is what people call the Ashtekar connection, and this is basically a densitized triad. This field here is the spin connection of the triad, and K, this field K here, is related to the extrinsic curvature of this metric, of this tree metric on the spatial slices. So here now I give you the constraints in full beauty. There's this NSE2 Gauss constraint. There's a so-called spatial diffeomorphism constraint. There's a Hamiltonian constraint. And turns out for the further analysis and for the further purposes of this talk that it's convenient to summarize them in the so-called master constraint. Master constraint because, as you can immediately see, setting M equal to 0 implies that all the other, that the individual constraints have to vanish separately. So the master constraint defines a constraint hypersurface in the phase space, and so-called gauge-invariant variables have to satisfy this condition. Gauge-invariance here means basically invariance under, of course, the internal rotations, SU2 rotations, and space-time diffeomorphisms. Now, general relativity is a covariant theory, and therefore you have the so-called problem of time, namely that there is no Hamiltonian, but there is only a Hamiltonian constraint, or in other words, this master constraint. In other words, there is no per se Hamiltonian which drives physical evolution of gauge-invariant quantities, and you have the so-called frozen picture. So this is, of course, it seems to be like this, that nothing ever happens in canonical quantum gravity, which is, of course, an obvious contradiction to observation. And there are several proposals to get out of this problem. One is the so-called relational ansatz that was also mentioned yesterday in the parallel session by Bianca Dittrich. And I give you a simplified version of it here on just one slide. It turns out that if you use suitable scalar fields, then by a mechanism which is due to Brown and Kugach, you can deparameterize the system. In other words, you can display the master constraint, or you can display the solution of setting the master constraint equal to zero as an infinite set of constraints of this form. And if you see here, I make the distinction between M and H, because H is going to be essentially the thing that is going to be a physical Hamiltonian. And here it is. It's just the integral over all points in the spatial slice of this density here. So this is going to be the physical Hamiltonian. And also gauge invariant observables have a very compact form in using this kind of matter. So these are now really Dirac observables, i.e. they are invariant under space-time diffeomorphisms. And the physical evolution is really driven by this Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has absolutely nothing to do with M. So M and M, H and M are not equal to each other. You can derive H from M, but it's not that M and H are equal to each other. So these are different concepts. The physical Hamiltonian has nothing to do with the constraints. So this was the classical setup. Let me now come to the first bit of quantum theory, which is quantum kinematics. Kinematics means that we don't care about the constraints yet. Constraints are imposed as operators on the so-called kinematical Hilbert space, where we look for solutions to the constraints, to the quantum constraints. And the quantization is based on lattice-inspired ideas. The basic objects in this framework are so-called holonomies, or you can also call them parallel propagators. Here's the formula. This means path-ordered exponential along one-dimensional lines. And these are the magnetic degrees of freedom of the theory. Then there are electric degrees of freedom, which are built from this densitized triad if you integrate them over two-dimensional surfaces. And you can derive the Poisson brackets or the Poisson structure from the basic Poisson structure using that A and E are canonically conjugate to each other. So here's what happens, for example, in the simple situation. You have an edge or path, a one-dimensional path, which happens to intersect the surface in one point only. And what happens if you compute the Poisson bracket is that basically you end up with two holonomies on the right-hand side, and there's a generator of SU2, of the Lie algebra of SU2 involved. This is Newton's constant. So you see that the functions of A and E are closed under Poisson brackets, and it turns out they are also closed under complex conjugation. So what this means is that you have an algebra of functions, a star algebra of functions, because you know how to take complex conjugates, and now you are in the realm of studying to impose the canonical commutational relations. So Poisson brackets should become commutators times I times h bar, and complex conjugates should become adjoints of operators on a certain Hilbert space. And now we want to study what Hilbert spaces are available. The cautionary remark here is that in quantum field theory, Hilbert spaces or representations of an algebra are never unique. That is already happening for scalar fields of Minkowski space, unless you put more physical input. Physical input is usually Poincaré invariants, and you also have to put some dynamical information, like for a free scalar field, you would have to provide the mass of the scalar field, for example. The result here is the following one. There's an existence theorem, which is quite old already. It's due to these people derived in the 90s. And there's also a uniqueness theorem derived basically, essentially by Hanno Salmann. And it says that representations which are such that the diffeomorphism group is unitarily represented on the Hilbert space are unique. So there's your dynamical information that we have put in, namely the spatial diffeomorphism group. Let me now describe the Hilbert space in brief terms. Wave functions are of this form. So you take some edges, a finite number of them, but arbitrary number of them, let's say E1 to EN, and then you evaluate the you construct the, or you compute the holonomy of the connection along those edges, and you get n group elements, and you can plug this group elements into a function which is a function which sends SU2 to n powers of SU2 to the complex numbers. So these are the basic wave functions in this Hilbert space. They're functions of the connection of this particular form. The holonomy operator essentially acts as a multiplication operator. The electric flux operator as basically as a derivative operator. So this is exactly analogous to the Schrödinger representation in quantum mechanics, and this is why this representation is so natural. And it's also unique if you impose diffeomorphism invariants. Here's a scalar product for those, for the experts among you. Basically, if you have two wave functions, I should have mentioned that what this label gamma means here. So if you have n edges, then of course you can consider the collection of these edges, and the collection of these edges combined to a so-called graph, which I denote by gamma. And if you have two wave functions for simplicity, which I take to be defined with respect to the same graph, then this is the physical scalar product between those two wave functions. Turns out that this Hilbert space has a nice basis, a so-called spin network basis. And you can think of this spin network functions as some kind of analog of the Hermite polynomials in usual Schrödinger quantum mechanics. You notice that spin network functions have three labels. One label is the graph on which everything is based, and then each edge is equipped with a spin quantum number. The spin comes in because we are using here holonomies valued in SU2, so you enter the representation theory of SU2, and that's why there are spins, because spins label irreducible representations of SU2. And then there are also other quantum numbers which are called intertwiners, which I'm not going to explain here. So you can also think of this pictorially. So graphs are labeled by these lines, and you can color these lines according to which spin they have, so just in order to get a pictorial view of what is going on here. So dark colors or violet or blue colors would correspond to high spin, and light colors or red colors, something like this, would correspond to low spin. And you can also think of this in a dual way. So if you have a simplicial complex, you can combine interior points of each tetrahedron by lines, and you get a dual graph. If you think of in terms of this, you get kind of a colored triangulated manifold. And there's also, so this is a still actually from an animation. This animation shows how the quantum Einstein equations act on such a colored simplicial complex. And you can download this animation in the following URL. I should mention that these faces here in this picture have something, or the colors in these faces have something to do with the area that is occupied by these faces, the quantum area. We'll come to the area operator in a second. So here it is. This is the classical area functional, and it's related to the basic objects that we have, namely the electric flux in this frame. And it turns out that you can actually quantize this operator, and this function on this kinematical Hilbert space. And this is not possible in any Fock space. So if you would try to do this on a Fock space, you would not be able to do it. It doesn't exist. The spectrum of this operator turns out to be explicitly known. It's entirely discrete, and it suggests that in loop quantum gravity we have a discrete space-time structure. And it suggests that you cannot resolve space-time distances which are shorter than about the Planck length. And there are similar results for length and volume operators. Here are some qualitative things about the spectrum of this area operator, so that there's an area gap in the spectrum, which turns out to be very important in order to show that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in loop quantum gravity is finite. And here we plot the logarithm of the number of eigenvalues as a function of the area divided by the square root of the area divided by the Planck length, and you see that this roughly gives you an exponential increase in the number of eigenvalues and as a function of air. So this is kind of correspondence principle. Just as the eigenvalues of the hydrogen atom crowd as much, the more as you go to the ionization energy scale. It turns out that there's a, we're still in the quantum kinematics. Turns out there's a very important tool for analysis here, which is the so-called coherent state. So you see, in loop quantum gravity, we don't have a background metric available, and therefore we also standard perturbation theory is very difficult to implement. But we have a different approximation tool here, which are so-called kinematical coherent states. What do I mean by this? I mean by this minimal uncertainty states for this Hollandmeier flux operators. So not only are, so these coherent states are labeled by a classical connection and a classical triad, and they are such that first of all the expectation values of holonomies and fluxes are recovered in those states. So they take the classical value that you plug in into those states, and the uncertainty, the Heisenberg uncertainty relation is saturated. This is just a plot which gives you an idea that these kind of states are Gaussian peaked around the phase space spaces, phase space points where you want them to be peaked. And now we enter the next part of the talk, which is the unsecured land. So these are now we are going to come to open or to the frontiers of current research. So and I have picked four topics here due to brevity of time, and the first one is going to be the definition of the quantum equivalent of the master constraint. So to make things very simple, I have chosen now a graph which is, has cubic topology, and I'm also choosing a cubic simplicial complex. So every vertex of the graph is surrounded by four faces which have the shape of squares. And we're going to, so we have edges and we have surfaces, and the direction of the surfaces and the edges I will label by the letter A. A runs from 1 to 3. So now we want to compare the difference between implementation of quantum dynamics in background-dependent and background-independent theories. So here I've given you a result which is quite old due to Kogut and Susskind, who tried to define quantum Young-Mills theory on such a cubic lattice in terms of these fluxes and holonomies. So alpha A of B is a loop, which is, so you have here a sum over vertices of the graph. And for each vertex of the graph, you have a loop, and the loop alpha labeled by the letter A is a loop which somehow encircles the A direction. So this is the B squared term in the Young-Mills Hamiltonian. This is the E squared term in the Young-Mills Hamiltonian, and you put everything on a lattice, and we are, of course, in a space time and in a background-dependent situation, so here we are on Minkowski space, and this epsilon here denotes the length of the edges in this Minkowski space with respect to the Minkowski metric. So you can put this on a lattice, and you can study the properties of this operator, but finally what you want to do is to send epsilon to zero. And so far, that hasn't been possible. So there's renormalization and regularization involved, but there's people nowadays do this in Euclidean framework, and there things are nicer, but in this Hamiltonian framework, that has never been possible. Now, when you do this for the master constraint, you have there are several differences, but for example, this operator is a little bit more complicated. It involves the volume operator, which can be expressed in terms of these flux operators in the following way. But don't worry about this. What I want to point out here is the following thing, that the Young-Mills Hamiltonian on the lattice has a 1 over epsilon there, and you want to send epsilon to 0. Now, the master constraint doesn't have such an epsilon, and this is because of background independence. There shouldn't be an epsilon appearing if you preserve background independence. There's no a priori metric with respect to which you can send some length to zero. There shouldn't be any additional length scale here other than the Planck scale. And in fact, if you look at this, this is the volume operator. The volume operator has also a discrete spectrum. The spectrum is proportional to the cube of the Planck length, so it's proportional to LP cube. Now, if you take the square here, then you get one, you get a factor of LP cubed in front of here, and there's an H bar over LP, which means that H bar over epsilon has been basically replaced by the Planck length. So there's your natural regularization of usual ultraviolet quantum field theory divergences. There's no continuum limit to be taken. The operator is finite. Now, we want to solve the constraint. So classically, remember that everything, the only interesting points in the phase space are those points where m is equal to zero. In the quantum theory, you impose this constraint as an operator on wave functions. And Dirac's basic idea was to do just this. So you look for solutions of this master constraint condition. And formally, you can write down the general solution. So psi, capital psi, is just the delta function of the operator times some arbitrary wave function in the kinematical Hilbert space. But the problem with this proposal is that, of course, this wave function is ill-defined. So you have to do something about it. So if you take the norm of this wave function, then you will enter a delta function squared, which is also illustrated in this calculation. So M turns out to be a self-adjoint operator. You can formally put this delta function on the right-hand side. And then you enter, you get a factor of delta of zero, which is infinite. But what you do, you choose a reference vector, psi naught, and you renormalize this inner product by this reference vector calculation, and these two delta functions cancel out. So the final answer is this one. The physical inner product is some positive number times this quantity. And this is a heuristic calculation. There's also a rigorous calculation which uses the spectral resolution of the self-adjoint master constraint operator. Let me now come to another question that is always asked in loop quantum gravity, namely the question about the semi-classical limit. And I will just sketch the result here. There's a talk by Christina Giesel this afternoon where you will learn more about the details of this calculation. So remember that we have states which are kinematical states. They don't solve the constraint. And what one wants to make sure that this constraint operator has been correctly quantized. Now, if you want to answer this question, so you would like to see if the semi-classical limit of this operator turns out to be the classical function. And this question can be only answered at the kinematical level, because if you have a solution to the master constraint, then of course, for example, expectation values of this operator in the solutions are zero, and that doesn't tell you anything about the correctness of the operator. So you have to use semi-classical coherent states in order to test to answer this question. So it turns out that you can answer this question using this coherent states that I sketched to you. So indeed, the expectation value of the master constraint is the classical object plus h bar corrections, and also the fluctuations are of the order of h bar. So what this means physically is that at least the quantum master constraint is correctly implemented. And if you take states which satisfy the coherent states, which are such that the phase space points on which they are peaked are such that the classical master constraint is equal to zero, then you get approximately physical states in the following sense, namely that the norm of M applied to this coherent state is approximately zero. So you can hope to do approximative calculations using those coherent states. So these are the results that we have concerning the master constraint. Now let me come to open problems. So it turns out that the physical Hilbert space is non-empty only if the spectrum of the master constraint does contain the zero. What if that doesn't happen? And you can show that, and this is something we don't know yet, if this doesn't happen, that means that in the original algebra of Hamiltonian constraints, there's an anomaly. And there are several proposals of going about this. Christina is going to mention some of them this afternoon. But certainly, there's no clear-cut strategy at the moment. Furthermore, the quantization of the master constraint has several freedoms. You can discretize it in several different ways, and if the result that the semi-classical limit is okay would still hold. but there are certainly these quantization ambiguities in the whole construction. So how can one fix them? If the spectrum of the master constraint contains zero, one would like to get more control on the solutions. So we have a kind of existence theorem about the solution space, but we don't have, if this condition holds, we have a kind of existence theorem, but we don't have these solutions in explicit form to do nice calculations with them. Would like to improve on that. Furthermore, one would like to make connections with other frameworks. For example, there will be a talk, I think, tomorrow by Klaus Friedenhagen on how quantum field theory on curved space-time is possibly connected with background-independent quantum field theory. Furthermore, one would like to see gravitons, scattering amplitudes, Feynman graphs in this picture. And there are some proposals by Varadarajan and Rovelli recently. Where's the randomization group, effective theories, and so on, in this framework? So there are several authors have worked on this. And furthermore, finally, what we are interested in, of course, gauge invariant operators, these Dirac observers. These have not been implemented in this physical Hilbert space yet, so this is also something that one would like to do. There will be a talk by Hanno Salman in a simplified context on this issue today, I think. And this issue of the Dirac observers, of course, has something to do, or which of the Dirac observers you choose, which physical Hamiltonian you choose, has to do with a good choice of clocks. And this, there's lots of work by Karel Tukács on this issue. Finally, as I said before, the master constraint has nothing to do with the physical time evolution. So as far as the classical limit of the master constraint is concerned, you are certainly safe to be satisfied with just the infinitesimal version, the operator itself. But for the physical time evolution, you would like to see that coherent states, which are now dynamical coherent states, are preserved by the time evolution, at least for a sufficiently long time in a macroscopic regime. There's some work by Martin Boyewald and Skirzewski on this. Let me come now to the next research topic, which is spinform models. All of this started in the seminal work by Reisenberg and Rovelli a long time ago. And the idea was, instead of using the master constraint, which was not yet on the market then, use this infinite number of Hamiltonian constraints instead. And now, instead of having a single delta function of one constraint, you have an infinite number of delta functions for each of the individual constraints. So this would be the formal solutions to the constraints. And then you use basically the same formula that I had before for the physical inner product in order to define the physical inner product using the Hamiltonian constraints. And this has the explicit action of this Hamiltonian constraints has led to the spin form picture. So here are graphs, and the Hamiltonian constraints acts by creating new edges on this graph. And this, if you combine the lines here with this dotted lines, then you get faces, and these are the faces of a spin form on two neighboring time slices. So this is how spin forms arise from the Hamiltonian framework, at least in this heuristic way. The problem with this proposal is that the Hamiltonian constraints do not mutually commute with each other. So the motivation for defining this as solutions, of course, is that each of these solutions should be annihilated by the C of X for each X or for each X, X naught. And this is not the case if these operators are not commuting. Furthermore, in order to define the right-hand side here, so delta of some real number X is just dk e to the I k x, right? So this is the motivation for defining the delta function like this. And here you have actually a functional integral. But this only works, or you can rigorously define this only if the C of n are self-adjoint operators. And this is not the case for the current proposals of the Hamiltonian constraint. And this has led to the master constraint, but also to a completely independent proposal to approach spin forms. And here's the idea, and many, many people are working on this. The idea is that you basically substitute by the Palatini action by BF theory. Of course, BF theory is not equivalent to Palatini, because this is a theory with propagating degrees of freedom. This is a theory which is topological. So you have to impose so-called simplicity constraints, which you already encountered when I introduced the classical phase space. And then the idea is that you consider the Palatini action or the Palatini action functional integral. You replace it by this function form here, and since we know a lot about the quantization of BF theory, you consider this term here as a kind of perturbation. In order to do this rigorously, you have to regularize this path integral. You use a triangulation, and you associate variables to the triangles of the triangulation and edges to the or edges of the dual graph of this triangulation to group elements. And after having done this, you substitute this integral over the connection by the harm measure over the corresponding group elements. And then using the Peter Weyl theorem, you can substitute this integral over group elements by summing over representations. This is how you get the spin form. Of course, there's an issue now about which triangulation you choose. In a topological quantum field theory, there's no issue because all the triangulations are lead to the same answer, but here this is not the case. And there's a proposal how to go about this. So you sum, basically you sum over all triangulations with certain weights which are suggested by group field theory. So this is the formula for group field theory. There's a perturbation parameter involved, and you get a sum over all triangulations which have a fixed number of holes in them. And this also suggests a connection with this Feynman graph. Feynman graph language. And the proposal is that the physical inner product should be correspond to the n equal to zero contribution to the sum. And this works all very beautifully in three dimensions. So you can do all, you can look at this from all possible sides and you get always very satisfactory answers. But this can be traced back, certainly to some extent at least, to the fact that this is a topological quantum field theory in three dimensions. In four dimensions, there are several issues. So one issue is that currently discussed models like the Barrett-Crane model seem to be peaked on degenerate histories, and you'll hear some about this, I think, in during the conference. The second class constraints, the simplicity constraints, they have not been correctly implemented yet in spin forms, which has been pointed out by these authors. Furthermore, the concrete way how do you go about these simplicity constraints shows that they're actually, at the moment, implemented in an anomalous way, and there are several proposals to go about this issue. And then there's this other issue which I've brushed over a little bit, namely that if you look at the solution to the simplicity constraint, which is a quadratic constraint, then you see that there are actually four possible solutions, and we are only interested in this one with a plus sign. So somehow in these path integrals, there are four sectors flying around, and we don't know what the physical significance of this is. So then there's also convergence issues of this perturbation series, the group field theory perturbation series. Is the group field theory scalar product positive? There was some work by Pfeiffer on this. And what is the precise connection between the canonical and the covariant formalism anyway? We now come to next research topic, which is black holes. And there's a very careful and nice analysis by the following authors. And it uses the notion of an isolated horizon. Isolated horizon is a local generalization of an event horizon. So you can talk about black holes at a certain period of time and black holes in equilibrium. And what is important for us is that this precise definition of isolated horizons leads to spatial hypersurfaces with an interior boundary, which is of the sphere topology, and leads to modifications of the canonical analysis. And what are these modifications which are important for us here? The interior boundary conditions make the area of this isolated horizon a Dirac observer. So this is now a gauge-invariant object that you can talk about. And the gauge-invariant surface information, which is of course of interest to us when you want to do black hole entropy calculations, consists of ordered n-tuples of intersection points where n is an arbitrary integer, up to diffeomorphisms together with the degeneracies of the associated spin network states. So this is a picture that you should have in mind. So there's a state with a bulk contribution and intersections with the surface, and there are spins running into the surfaces. Now, the entropy calculation has been done, and what you basically do is you count the number of states whose error eigenvalue falls in a certain interval, which is of the order of some classical area minus the Planck square and area of this area plus this Planck scale, and you can plug in the known spectrum of this area operator. And what you get is that in the microcanonical ensemble, we find that the entropy is actually of the Wittgenstein-Hawking form plus logarithmic corrections, provided that this parameter beta that was floating around all the time, which is also called the Mirzi parameter, by the way, that this takes a certain value, which I'm not going to display here. And one could say that the microscopic explanation in loop quantum gravity for this entropy is our polymer-like excitations of geometry. Now let me say that this calculation now completely changes the split picture that was suggested to us by Toft and Susskind. The horizon that you think about is not composed of phases which have one or zero kind of information, but they have colored information, so all possible kind of spins can sit on the surfaces. So this is the picture that you get from loop quantum gravity. Then we come to open problems. So one secret assumption in all these calculations is that in the bulk, the master constraint should have a non-vanishing solution, should have a non-trivial solution, and this hasn't been checked. Another thing that one would like to improve in the future is the following. The analysis has a significant part of classical input. Is there a possible way to have a complete quantum definition of an isolated horizon or maybe of a trapping horizon? Can one get Hawking radiation from first principles just using quantum geometry? A question that comes up, and this is asked by Ted Jacobson frequently, is there a renormalization of Newton's constant in loop quantum gravity? And if yes, can this be absorbed in this Mirzi parameter, which of course would change the answer again? And there are several other puzzles which I don't want to go into details. There's some puzzle with quasi-normal modes due to Olaf Dreyer, and then there's also some very strange effect in this entropy counting. If you vary this interval into which the eigenvalues should fall due to Corici and others. The last part of my presentation now concerns singularity avoidance. So the idea is rather simple. You remember that singularities have something to do with divergences of the curvature tensor. And here's, this is basically the Einstein-Hilbert action, which could be counted as a measure for this divergences. And you can express it in terms of our canonical variables in the following form. And what you could do now is consider a coherent state peaked on a on a trajectory which runs into a classical singularity, like a black hole singularity or a cosmological singularity. And then you can calculate the expectation value in these coherent states of this operator. And the result it turns out to be that the curvature operator is not bounded, but its expectation value is finite in these coherent states for cosmological and black hole singularities. However, while this is encouraging, this is not really what you should do. What you should do from first principles is compute the physical Hilbert space and physical coherent states, choose physical clock and physical Hamiltonian, so that you can talk about gauge invariant quantities and actual physical time evolution rather than just gauge transformations, and then monitor expectation values of Dirac observers in these physical coherent states, using the actual quantum time evolution rather than the classical one. And it turns out, and this is very beautiful, all this is possible in certain truncated models of loop quantum gravity, which we are going to hear about in the next talk and also in the talk by Martin Boyewald and others, I think. In certain truncated models, which are sometimes called loop quantum cosmology, because most of this work has been done in cosmological context so far, you can show that all of this happens. And what loop quantum cosmology is basically is the mini superspace models that you used to from classical general relativity, but now quantized with loop quantum gravity methods induced from the full theory. And this is a good test of the full theory. And there are spectacular results in this framework. For example, you can drive the physical evolution through the singularity, and there's a pre-Big Bang scenario. So I'm not going to more into details, because this is basically what Abhay is going to tell us. So what are the open research problems here? We would like to improve on this, make the mini superspace assumption weaker and weaker, and actually finally get into the full theory. If you can't do the full theory exactly, which I assume will happen, because the theory is much too complicated, can we do kinematic calculations, which are good approximations to the actual physical calculations that one should do? Again, this issue, what should be the chosen clocks and the physical Hamiltonian? How to obtain gauge invariant physical states? And there's some work in progress on this, which we're going to hear about this afternoon as well. And then another proposal would be to see the loop quantum cosmology framework as an actual sector, an invariant subspace in the loop quantum gravity framework. And this would make the whole thing, of course, much more robust. And there's work on this by the following authors. I think I'm out of time, so let me skip further things that I wanted to mention about phenomenology, DSR type of things, the cosmological constant, and other things. Let me just close with saying that loop quantum gravity is a candidate for quantum gravity. It has a mathematically rigorous formulation, which is and the conceptual setup, which I think is very beautiful because it's minimalistic. And there's tons of things to do and can be done in order to make progress. And I have been sloppy on many things, so let me advertise my book, which is coming out in September. Thank you very much for your attention.
Beautiful and comprehensive survey. I'll look for a few moments of questions, comments. If you dazzle the audience. Anybody?
This is a beautiful talk.
That's like an excellent one. Question. Suppose proper time would be quantized.
Mm-hmm.
How would that fit into this formula?
So proper time has to be along some. You have to specify along which curve. Presumably, would be a geodesic.
Choose your loops spatially.
Okay.
Suppose I take a time loop. There's a second order form of that.
Right.
Well, time loop. So the quantization could show up there. How would that fit into this formula?
So as I said, I mean, you would have to choose a certain curve along which you would take the proper time. Presumably, you would take a certain geodesic. I would take the classical formula which you get for this curve, and then quantize it using those methods. So you have, of course, there are not only spatial points on this curve, but they are also extends in the time direction, and you use the physical time evolution in order to label those points. So you use the physical Hamiltonian.
And you then get the eigenvalues for the time.
Well, this hasn't been done yet, but
that could be possible.
Yes. This hasn't been done yet, but it could be. There's a time.
Thank you. Alan.
This is a really naive question, so I'm going to forgive me for that.
This is important. This is a very naive question. If you start the metric or the connecting form quantizing and come up with a microscopic theory describing microscopic structure of space, opinion about what you're doing. Why is it so difficult to come back to reproduce the classical space time or getting the semi-classical limits?
So basically, what people mean by a semi-classical limit is not generally accepted in the literature. So the one proposal that I have followed here is using coherent states. And why it has been so difficult to reach this answer is that the calculation is very difficult. That's basically why it's so. First of all, you have to construct semi-classical states for this kind of new algebra of operators. It's not of the harmonic oscillator kind of type. So therefore, you have to invest several years of research in constructing those. And then you have to do the calculation for this kind of very nonlinear operators. So that has been very difficult.
So the microscopic structure that you discovered, right, this whole program, actually has a lot more than the direct correspondence of what you could use in the same classical structure.
Of course, yeah. Recovering the semi-classical limit is only one thing, but of course the challenging or the thrilling thing is in the corrections, and this you can also compute. So.
One question over here.
Yes, my question is, to what extent is it possible, or what are the difficulties to make contact with the effective field theory approach you heard yesterday about?
So far there's very, very little on this issue, but we are certainly aware of it, and the difficulty is that effective field theory usually uses the framework of Euclidean field theory. And this makes very much use of the following fact that in Minkowski space you can Wick rotate between Minkowski and Lorentzian signature using the fact that you have a fixed background metric. But here in this game, we don't have a fixed background metric. Our metric is an operator. So Wick rotation per se doesn't make any sense. So it's very difficult to make contact with the usual language of effective field theory using Wick rotations and stuff like this. What one would have to do is to use the Lorentzian framework of effective field theories, and then to translate step by step all the things that like integrating out the degrees of freedom in the Lorentzian picture and translate it into this picture. And there's work in progress on that, but so far there's no result.
A question from Paul.
Just last session, some extent from my talk today this morning. Thomas, my question to you, which is practice related, is it possible to think of taking the master constraint and computing its expectation values on one around the minimum values to measure and compare it with uniform vertices?
Should be possible. I mean, I guess the calculation would be very difficult, but in principle, there's no obstruction to doing that. You know? In fact, I mean, one should do it sometime.
Any further questions? Not, let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.
Thank you.